Matthew chapter 17. We're walking our way slowly through the book of Matthew. I hope the word through is correct. I hope one day we'll get through. But to be honest, if the rapture takes place, that'll be fine too. But I appreciate the Lord being so good to us. Jesus told his disciples directly and clearly that he was going to be crucified, that he was going to be mistreated, going to be abused, going to be killed, and then he would raise again. And they didn't get it. They just missed it. But then in chapter 17, verse 24, it says, "And when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, Doth not your master pay tribute?" One of those that collected what's called tribute here came to Peter. I don't know why he came to Peter. Perhaps it was because Peter had a house in that city in Capernaum. And maybe since he was the landowner, that's why they approached Peter. Maybe they knew enough about Peter to know he was the big mouth of the group, or maybe one of the highest officials of the group, whatever. But he came to Peter and asked, "Does your master not pay tribute?" One thing we're going to find out in these verses is that Jesus teaches that there's more to Christianity than a bunch of spiritual facts and figures. There's a whole lot more to living for the Lord than just doing all the right things and keeping all the rules. It's a daily walk of living for Him and loving Him. And Jesus is going to teach the disciples once again another lesson. And this is going to be about stewardship and finances. So this person comes and asks Peter if Jesus pays tribute. Now the tribute that he's talking about here is not talking about taxes. It's talking about an annual fund that was received to pay the expenses of the temple. There was a rule, if you will, I guess that's the right word. There was a request, probably a better word, that every Jewish male from 20 years old and older each year would give 2 shekels that go to the fund that would keep the temple going. That helps me to realize that there is some financial needs to any kind of ministry, whether it's a church or radio broadcast or of an evangelistic ministry or whatever type of ministry. There are some finances involved, and God uses people to provide for His ministries. Always has, and I believe He always will. But this person, whoever was, probably one of the collectors of this fund, came to Peter and said, "Does your master pay tribute?" Now, they are probably trying to trick Peter or try to trip up Jesus, trying to use this in some way to ruin the testimony of Jesus or to somehow spread the word that he doesn't take care of God's finances or the temple. But he asked Peter this question. And in verse 25, he saith, Peter, "Yes." And when he was coming to the house, Jesus prevented him, saying, "What thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers?" Now, Peter, just like always, he answered the question quickly. He said, "Yes, Jesus surely pays tribute. Surely he provides. He takes care of these funds. He surely would not disrespect the temple or anything that had to do with the house of God or the work of God." He answered quickly. Now, fortunately, he answered correctly this time. He didn't always, but he did this time. And when he comes into the house, it's probably his own house, Jesus is there. And Jesus says, when he comes into the house, it says Jesus prevented him. What that simply means is that Jesus spoke before Peter did. And to do that, you probably had to be pretty quick. But Jesus was quick, and he said, "What thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers?" Now the question is this: should we pay tribute? Should we give to this fund that goes to the provision, the function, and the operation of the temple? That's the question. And Jesus asked Peter this question: the kings of the earth. Now, in that day, they had kings, and a king was the ruler. A king was the king. A king was in charge. A king did what he wanted to do. And Jesus asked, the kings of this earth, do they pay custom? Or do they take custom? Excuse me, do they take taxes? Do they take money from children, which means their own family, or strangers, which means anybody outside of the family? Who pays taxes, strangers or the children of the king? Verse 26, Peter saith unto him, of strangers. Jesus saith unto him, then are the children free. Now, follow me with this. It's not that complicated. Somebody asked Peter, does your master pay tribute? Does he give to this fund that provides the needs of the temple? Peter quickly says yes, and Jesus says, who do the kings collect money from? Who pays these funds? Does the king collect money from his own family? Or does the king collect money, taxes, from the strangers or from the people outside of the family? And Peter again answers right, of strangers. Now here's the point. A king does not collect taxes from his own family. The king in that day, there the royal family was exempt from paying taxes, from paying this tribute. And really that makes sense, because the king is taking taxes or receiving this money to provide for the needs of the kingdom. And part of the needs of the kingdom was his household. It's kind of like our president, Donald Trump, and his household. Their needs are being met because of taxes, our taxes. We are paying taxes, and they are living and existing, and their place that they live is provided, and their transportation is provided, and their food is provided, and everything's provided by those taxes. So in that day, a king's household was exempt from taxes because why take money from your own children and then use that money to provide for them? Do you understand what I'm saying? So Jesus and Peter agree that the taxes are received from people outside of the king's family. And then he says this, that the children are free. In other words, the children of the king, the children of royalty, do not have to pay taxes. And that's exactly what he's saying. Here's what Jesus is saying. I am the king. I am the Lord. I am God of all, including the temple. So if you want to ask me the question, should I pay tribute? The answer is saying, well, I don't have to. If anybody is exempt from paying tribute to the temple, surely the Lord of the temple would be. He says, but I give anyway. I pay anyway. Look in verse 27. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea and cast an hook and take up the fish that first cometh up. And when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money. That take and give unto them for me and for thee. Now, we don't want to miss this miracle. Jesus sends Peter out into to the sea, out to the shore. And he says, drop a hook. He did not say bait the hook. He said, drop a hook. And the fish that's caught on that hook will have a coin in his mouth. You take that coin and pay for my taxes or my tribute, the amount that I should give and the amount that you should give. We got a miracle going on here. Notice, again, before I even mention that Jesus says, I do not want to offend them. I do not want to be the cause of them rejecting me. They're looking for a reason, you know that. Any reason, any excuse they have to reject Christ, they would. And if it's nothing more than he doesn't even pay tribute to the temple, why in the world would I believe him? Why should I accept him? So Jesus said, lest we offend them, to make sure they can't use this as an excuse to turn away from me. Peter, you go and cast a hook. Again, the first part of the miracle is the fact that he caught a fish without bait. The second part of the miracle was the fact that he caught a fish on a hook to begin with. In that day, in that area, they did not fish with hooks. In fact, this is the only time in the New Testament we find fishing done with a hook. Only time. Unique. And the reason they did not fish with the hooks was because the food supply in that area was so plenteous that the fish had plenty to eat. And one little worm on one little hook would lure no fish. That's why they used nets to catch the fish. So it's a miracle, first, because he used a hook with no bait. It's a miracle, secondly, because he used a hook instead of a net. It was literally impossible to catch a fish with a hook in that day. But also, it was a miracle because there's a fish with a coin in his mouth. Now, how did the coin get there? Did God just miraculously make it appear? Was there some fisherman up on the surface that accidentally dropped a coin and it went down and the fish got it? I don't know how, but I know this, it's still a miracle. It's still something that God orchestrated. It's something that God controlled. The fact that a fish had a coin in his mouth was a miracle. Will you say this? It was at least very unique. But also, it was the fact that it was in his mouth. You do know what a fish mouth is, right? A fish mouth is to get in that fish what he's going to take into his stomach. A fish doesn't take something into his mouth and leave it there, but this one did. A fish takes something in his mouth to swallow it, to eat it, but this fish took it in his mouth and kept it there. That's another miracle. I'm talking about this little miracle, something that's big when you look at it closely. So here's a fish with a coin in its mouth, and also the fish is exactly where Peter is, at the exact right place. But also Peter went to the right place. I'm telling you, here's a little miracle that God does and doesn't mention a whole lot about it. And he does that so many times, as I mentioned just the other day. He's a God who works miracles and doesn't even brag about it. But here's what he does. Another part of the miracle is it was the exact amount that they needed. I mean, God works this. Now, let's move on to chapter 18. I want to get to this and try and cover. I want to try and cover more than we can cover. Chapter 18, Jesus begins to deal with humility. He's going to teach the disciples and us the importance of humility, of being humble. Through these first 14 verses, he mentions these little ones. So in the first 14 verses, he's dealing with one subject primarily, and that is the fact of being humble. And we're going to see that. Look in verse 1. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest of the kingdom of heaven?" In the kingdom of heaven. At the same time means while they're still in the house. While this conversation is going on between Peter and Jesus, here comes the disciples. Peter undoubtedly leaves to go get the fish and deal with all the coin and everything. And the disciples come up and start talking with Jesus and says, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Mark tells us in Mark 9, verse 33 through 37, that they had actually been arguing. Listen to this. About which of them was going to be the greatest of the kingdom of heaven. A bunch of bums, I'm telling you, arguing among themselves about which of them was going to be the greatest when the kingdom comes. They're still expecting the kingdom. And this kingdom, of course, in their view, has different levels of authority. And they're wondering which of us is going to have the highest seats. And they're not just discussing it or wondering about it. They're arguing about it. We see here the absolute worst display of selfishness. They're looking toward power. They're looking toward prestige. They want the best position. But the bad thing about it is they think they deserve it. It's one thing to want it. Something else when you think you deserve it. And these disciples thought they deserve it. So they've been arguing about it, and they come to Jesus and ask, which is going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Now, when you're talking about earthly kingdoms, wanting to be promoted is pretty much expected. You get a job and you want to advance. You start a business, you want it to grow. That's almost expected, almost normal, and to be honest, to be contrary to that would be a little bit unique and maybe would be lazy. But in an earthly kingdom, promotion and getting up the ladder is accepted. But in His kingdom, in Jesus' kingdom, it's not wanting to be promoted that He honors. It's wanting to be humbled. Not looking to be the highest, but to be the lowest. We're going to see that. Jesus had already taught them about self-denial, but they had missed it, no doubt about it. There's no doubt that this grieved Jesus. Jesus knows the cross is ahead. And He has humbled Himself to go to the cross. The Master of the universe, the God of all things, has humbled Himself and become lowest of lows, even to the death of the cross. And here's His disciples wanting to be promoted and wanting to be exalted and believing they deserved it. It must have broke His heart. And no doubt it grieved Him. And He says, they said, who is the greatest of the kingdom of heaven? And it already talked about, as I've already said, they were disputing about it in Mark chapter 9, verse 33. He's about to pop their bubble. He's about to show the greatest is the one that's the least. Verse 2. And Jesus called a little child unto Him and set him in the midst of them. Boy, Jesus knew what to do. He's going to use a little boy as an object lesson. Here's these mighty adult men who think they're so great and so magnificent, and everybody ought to bow to them. They deserve the best of the best. They deserve the high seats. And Jesus uses a little boy as an object lesson. Mark 9:36 says He took him in His arms. The Son of God with a little boy in His arms, on His lap. What a sight that must have been. Verse 3. And said, verily I say unto you, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. They believed they deserved to be promoted. They believed they deserved the best and highest. And Jesus uses a little boy to show them that they don't deserve anything. Listen, He used a little boy as an example about promotion. Now, that's not normal. If you're in a business and somebody wants to use someone as an example about promotion, you know what they're going to do? They're going to get the most successful CEO, the salesman that had the highest sales last year, the salesperson of the year, the one that looks the best and does the best. They're going to get the best of the best and the highest of the highest. If they're going to talk about promotion, and that's what these disciples are talking about, who's the greatest in the kingdom? But Jesus, instead of using a CEO or salesperson of the year and the one that's rich and famous, uses a little boy and He says, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. He reminds them how they got into the kingdom to begin with. He said, you remember you got in by humbling yourself and becoming like a little boy or a little child. You humbled yourself like a little child that depends on somebody else. Depends on mama and daddy to provide. Depends on mama and daddy for milk. Depends on mama and daddy for food. Depends on mama and daddy for a place to live and for clothes. He said, you can't even enter my kingdom unless you humble yourself. And He reminds them, you do remember how you got in, right? You were converted. You turned away from your sin and you turned to Me. And that's how you got in. Look in verse 4. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same as the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus tells us here how He promoted His disciples. He took the least. Humbled and broken, contrite, convicted, repentant, believing. That's what a sinner does to get saved. And made them one of the greatest. He said, the greatest in My kingdom is the one that's the lowest. The one that humbles himself. The greatest in man's kingdom is the one that does the best. And the CEO and the promoted and the highest. But not in My kingdom. My kingdom, the one that's greatest, that's the one that humbles himself. in the world's kingdom. It's the one that pushes himself to the top and promoted to the highest position. But not in my kingdom. In my kingdom, the greatest are the ones that, if you will, pushes themselves to the bottom and humbles themselves. There's no greater example of pride, as I've said before, as to think you ought to be first, to think you deserve it. See, there's competition in the ranks. All the disciples are wanting the best, and Jesus is trying to stop that. He reminds them again how they got into the family by humbling themselves. By the way, we don't ever outgrow that. We got in the family by humbling ourselves and trusting God and knowing if He doesn't save me, I'll not get saved. But that's how we're to walk. You know what? The last day of my life, the last moment of my life, I'll need God just as much as the second I got saved. The greatest lesson we can learn is that we need God every day of our lives, and we are nothing without Him. That's what He's trying to teach these disciples. Look at verse 5. And whoso shall receive one such child in my name receiveth me. Now, the one such child, there's a lot of debate. Does he mean just a little boy, a little child, a literal child, or does he mean little children of his family? I have bounced back and forth, to be honest, to where my brain feels like a yo-yo. But I've gotten settled on the fact that I believe he's talking about those who have believed on him, his little children in the family. And he says, whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. The word receiveth is important. It's the idea of receiving someone. Remember, we've talked about before that travelers could stop at families' homes along the road and they would receive them in for the night. That's the same word here. It means you are helping someone. It means you are opening your arms to someone. You are benefiting someone. You're helping someone in need. And Jesus is talking about somebody who helps his little children, who opens their arms to them, that are good to them, that are there when they need them. Now, the strange thing about it is that he said when somebody receives one of my little children, they're receiving me. Now remember what he's talking about, very important. Whether I get through this or not, I need to explain this. I don't want to just skip over things. He's talking about being promoted. All this is talking about being promoted and exalted and the best of the best for the kingdom and who gets the highest seats and the highest places. And he says, the person who receives one of my little ones is receiving me. Now, I want to ask you a question. If you're starting a new job and you're wanting to impress the boss and you're wanting to get promoted and you're wanting to get noticed and you want attention from the owner, what are you going to do? Are you going to go out there in the warehouse and find some little old servant, some little lowlife and try to impress them? Do good to them? No, you're going to try and do good to the boss man. You're going to try and find the highest person you can. There's a term for that. I won't use it, but they're trying to do good to those for selfish reasons. And Jesus said in the world, if somebody wants to be promoted, they'll try and find the highest official they can and do good to them. It wouldn't be the only salesperson that was good to the boss man because they wanted a promotion. It wouldn't be the only employee that was good to the owner because they wanted a promotion. But Jesus says, in the world, you do good to the highest. But in my kingdom, you do good to the lowest, to the least. If you want promotion, don't try and elevate yourself. Humble yourself. When you receive, listen, the least, it's just like receiving me. When you're good to them, it's just like being good to me. Boy, what a blessing it is. Jesus turns everything upside down. I hope you're getting this. We need to understand the reason he's doing that. They're still desiring promotion, and they try to, anybody who wants promotion associates with somebody to where they can get up the ladder. Look on in verse 6. But But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, notice these little ones which believe in me. I believe he's talking about people who are saved, his little children in the family, not just literal children. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, that he was drowned in the depth of the sea. Now, here he's talking about how he protects his disciples. In verse 5, he talks about people being good to these little ones. Somebody who receives. Somebody who helps. Someone who assists. And when they are good to mine, they're being good to me. When they receive mine, it's like just like them receiving me. But now he turns the coin around. And he's talking, instead of being good, he's talking about being bad. He says that those that offend, notice, whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me. He said, those that cause my little ones to stumble. The word offend means to stumble or cause to fall. It has the idea of making somebody do wrong or causing someone to do what's not right. And Jesus said, when someone does something to one of my children that leads them to do wrong, it's just like they did that to me. It's just like they did that wrong to me. You see, our influence does make a difference. A loose life can make a difference to someone else. We can cause people to fall or to sin directly. In other words, someone who says, let's go get drunk. Let's go steal. Let's rob this woman from her purse directly. Suggesting, pushing, prodding someone to do wrong that's causing someone to offend or to do wrong. We can cause somebody to fall directly, and there's been many lives that have been ruined because some friend or some acquaintance led that person into sin. First time I ever shoplifted was because one of my buddies dared me. And that's what I'm talking about. We can cause people to sin or to fall directly. We can cause people to fall indirectly simply by our influence. If we're living in the world, we're going to cause somebody else to live in the world. If we're walking, if anybody's walking a sinful distance, it's going to be an influence to someone else. It's going to be an influence to some child of God somewhere. And that's exactly what Jesus is saying here. That's why we should not love the world, because our influence does make a difference. Our influence is greater than we realize. And Jesus warned us to not take it lightly. He said, those that offend one of my little ones, it's just like them offending me. What they do to mine, they're doing to me. You parents know that. Somebody mistreats your children, they just will do it to you. Somebody good to your children, they just will do it to you. That's exactly what Jesus is saying here. Notice what he says. Let's read the verse again. Whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone be hanged about his neck and that he be drowned in the depth of the sea. He said, if you think your influence doesn't matter, I've got news for you, it does. Because for you to wrong one of my little ones, it upsets me. And it would be better for you to have a millstone hung around your neck and be thrown into the sea. You know what you're going to do. You're going to go straight down and drown. And by the way, for the Jews, that was terrifying. Jews were terrified of drowning. So for these Jews, this was a big deal. He, in other words, was saying you'd be better off dead than do. Listen, you'd be better off dead than mistreat one of my children. Boy, you will not go unpunished. God promises a deal with those who wrong his children. We suffer. Anybody suffers the wrath of God, and our God is a consuming fire. His wrath is waiting on those that does his children wrong. shows how serious God is about holiness, and it shows you how much he hates sin, and shows you how much he loves his children. I hope I don't need to, but I'll say it. If any of us are living a loose life, we ought to do ourselves a favor and not hang around anybody. That loose life influences someone else. And that loose life, says Jesus, is so serious that you'd be better off to kill yourself, commit suicide, than to keep it up. We need to realize how important our influence is. How important it is that we do what's right. So important. He promised a protection like a loving father that protects his children. Look in verse 7. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs to be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. Again, he's talking about offenses or sinning or somebody who does wrong. And he's still talking about the wrath of God that comes to those who offend. And he says, woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs that offenses come. He says, woe to this world. That's a word of grief, woe, curse, abomination, fear, anguish. He says, woe to this world because of the... Here's what he's saying. Woe to the world because of the things they do that cause my children to do wrong. This whole world is just contaminated. This whole world is filthy. This whole world is perverted. And Jesus said, woe to this world that has any negative influence on my children. Well, I'll tell you one thing. The world may not think much of us, but God does. The world may take us lightly, but God doesn't. He says, woe to the one, this world, that causes that because of offenses. It must needs that offenses come. He said, you can't stop it. The world's going to be full of offenses. There's going to be sin in the world. Man's depraved and man's lost and man's going to live like a lost person. You can't escape the world. You can't escape sin. But that does not excuse anybody. Rest of the verse. But woe to that man by whom the offense is coming. The world may be cankered. The world may be perverted. Everything may be out of sorts and against God, but that gives nobody the right or the excuse to do wrong. Woe to the man that of whom the offense cometh. It doesn't give anybody the excuse to do wrong. Look on in verse 8 and 9. Wherefore thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut it off and cast them from thee. It better for thee to enter into life halt or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if thy hand offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into the hell fire. There's no doubt here Jesus now turns his attention to those that are lost in the room. And he says about a hand and a foot and an eye. And he says, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut it off. And if thy eye offend thee, pluck it out. What does that mean? If where your feet carry you causes you to sin, cut your foot off. If what your hand does causes you to sin, cut your hand off. If what you're looking at causes you to sin or offend me, plug your eyes out. Now, he's surely not saying cut one foot off or one hand off or pluck one eye out. That wouldn't deal with the problem. You can still look with the other eye. You could hobble to it. You could still do it with one hand. What he's saying is deal with the root of the problem and deal with it severely. You see, we use our bodies, our hand, our feet, our eyes, either to glorify God or to please self. Bottom line, Jesus said, use your body to please me. Use your body to glorify me. And if you're using your body to please self, stop it. Whatever it takes, stop it. However severe you have to do or deal with it. I don't know how much more severe you could get than cutting your hand off or cutting your foot off or plucking your eye out. But notice what he says. Verse 10. Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. Again, he's talking about despising the little ones. It talks about abusing or neglecting or disesteem or not appreciating or undervaluing God's people. I'll say it again. The world may not think much of us, but God does. And he says, those that despise my little ones, just want to remind you, there's angels watching over. Now, some people have used this to say that everybody has a guardian angel. The wording here really suggests that all the angels are watching. To be honest, I'd rather have them all than one. I can't say either way, but the wording seems to suggest that all the angels are looking toward God, and all it would take is one word from the Father. If somebody's mistreating us or we're being wronged, all it's going to take is just a nod from God, and they're going to come down here and take care of it. And the angels can do that. What he's saying is, I protect my own. You may not think much of them, but I do. I love them. I protect them. And angels, no doubt, are ministering spirits. We'll just stop here. Let's just go on. We'll read these other verses, and I want to finish them. Verse 11, for the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. He's talking here about, again, now he's talking about his disciples, the little ones that he has pursued, that he has gone after. Those that were saved in that room, the Lord had pursued them, had gone after them, had sought them out, just like we're going to see in just a minute. By the way, just like he did us, look in verse 12. How think ye a man of 100, if a man have 100 sheep, and one of them be gone astray, do they not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains and seeketh that which is gone astray? He uses himself as an illustration, and he says it's like a shepherd that has 100 sheep, and one of them has gone astray. Well, he's going to leave the 99 and go and find that one that has gone astray. He talks here about the condition of lost people. Look at verse 13. And if so be that he find it, verily I say to you, he rejoiceth more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray. I understand that. Here's a sheep that goes astray. The shepherd goes out into the wilderness searching for that sheep because of his concern, because of his care, because of his compassion. He's longing for that sheep's return. He's concerned about the safety of the sheep. He goes after, he goes through the wilderness himself, through the difficulty of night and day, the heat of the day and the cool of the night, and the mountains and the briars and the brambles and the rocks and everything else. He's hunting for the sheep, and when he finds that sheep, he has more joy over it than the 99 that never did go astray. It's kind of like children. Those that never cause us trouble, we surely rejoice about. But the one that did cause trouble, broke your heart, you prayed for, you agonized over, you wept about. But then they get right. There's more joy, a different kind of joy, over the one that repented than the ones that never did go astray. That's exactly what he's saying here. I understand that completely. We need to realize, look on in verse 14. For even so is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. He's saying, listen, he's talking to a group. Some are lost, some are saved. And he said, these little ones that are saved, I pursued them. And I pursued them, and like a shepherd going after a lost sheep, I went after them. And I went after them because I loved them. He says, it's not the will of your Father that any would perish. Now, if we're not careful, we'll misunderstand what he's saying here. We'll use that verse, these verses, to say that he's talking about you can be saved and lose your salvation. That's not what he's talking about at all. One thing's very important, and I'll try and say this and quit. Anytime there's a parable or an illustration or an object lesson, which this is, You cannot take it too far. I mean, if you take every single detail of this shepherd and these sheep and that sheep and all that, there's no telling what you can come up with. Here's the picture. Get this, don't miss it. God and man was united to begin with. Shepherd and sheep in unity, in communion. They were together. We call it God and Eve, God and Adam. They were in communion. But man went astray, and God pursued. And that's exactly what we're finding here. Man turned from God, and just like a sheep went astray, but God pursued them. And those, notice the wording, even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. He went after them one by one, one at a time. And if you're saved, he found you. He pursued you until he found you.